Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. The Last Voyage by Tom Filer. The first time she lost her grip and he slid down the ladder to the deck below, where he lay spread-eagled, eyes wide and staring, mouth parted, as if he were about to cry out in protest. She tried again. It was no use. She was strong, but she was no match for the passive stubbornness of death. Finally, she decided to use the winch. There seemed no way of doing it that did not outrage her senses, for this limp bundle had once been her husband. "They couldn't wait," she cried. "Couldn't let us be." With the sudden impatience that verged on anger, she roughly tied the line about his waist. She raised him, jackknifed, arms waving as though with a new life in the unlife, and set him down beside the gearbox on the con deck. Now she had to empty the box. It contained a lot of fishing tackle, mostly new, but she came upon some moth-eaten lures that had been buried there and forgotten. Among them was one her husband had made. "Must have had some kind of magic, May," Ed often said, grinning. "Fish always hit it first, every time." And then May would remind him of her contribution to the lure, a red feather from the hat she had worn on their honeymoon. The joke grew old with them, never tired of, for it reminded them of that first voyage 26 years ago. The fish had chewed up most of their lures, and Ed, fresh out of Macon's, impulsively removed the feather without telling her, intending to replace it when they reached port. The next afternoon, as May pulled in an albacore, the barbless lure didn't snap loose, and she had to remove it by hand. Instantly, she recognized the feather. Ed had pleaded with her to start chumming the sardines before the school sounded, but May responded with an icy stare and went into the cabin. Later, when he tried to talk to her, she retired silently to the chain locker, where she spent the night despite his repeated vows that he would buy her a dozen hats when they returned to San Diego. In the morning, her only problem was how to emerge without losing face. Ed had solved this dilemma by shouting down to her that they were into a big school. She suspected a trick, but scrambled out of the locker when she heard the unmistakable thrashing of a fish on the deck above. Ed had grabbed her before she realized the school was a lone dolphin. With a cry of anger, she fought him, but Ed held her so tightly the strength drained from her fists and thrusting knees, and the fool was laughing. His hard body, the pulsing engines, and the soft rush of the parting sea all seemed to envelop her as they tumbled to the deck. And then, with a fury that made her anger seem pale, she met him with a fierce joy. There had been a son, and she had been told there would be no more. And in her most secret self she was glad, for after that first voyage she had felt a need to be more than a mother, more than a wife to a man. There were 4 lonely years at home, and then Ed's partner walked out and May returned to the Gull. The child, Sonny, was left with Ed's parents during the school year and the rest of the time he spent on the boat. And soon he was fishing with them, and he had stayed with the Gull until he was 20, until Ed sailed without him one July night. May had known the truth, of course. So had Sonny. Ed felt the Gull was too old and too slow to amount to much anymore, and while this no longer mattered much to him, Sonny was young. Ed didn't fit very well in the box, but she found by raising his knees and lifting his head she could manage. She went below for ice. His face, almost level with the rim of the box, could not be covered completely. The ice was neatly packed about him, and the job was done except for this. She fought an uncontrollable urge to force the gaping face down, down into the blue whiteness of the ice. She lowered the lid, knowing she must return within the hour with more ice. May switched on the radio transmitter in the cabin below. "Hello, Sarah! Hello, Sarah! This is the Gull, WCT-3, calling... Hello, Sarah." She turned on the receiver. There was no reply. She tried again until a voice came through. "Hello, Ma. This is Sonny. Start talking so we can get another bearing on you. You may have drifted. Out." "I did what they told me, Sonny," she said. "I've got to get back to packing the fish, so I don't have much time. Is there anything else I should do?" "Out." "Okay, Ma. Got a line on you. You better call every hour. Keep the engine idling so long as you got fuel, or the radio'll poop out." He seemed to hesitate. "Needed for the refrigeration, too." "Out." "I turned the engine off after it happened," May replied. What could she tell him? There seemed to be some explanation due for this action, but she could think of nothing that would satisfy her son. "I'll start it again, Sonny. Out." "Okay, just sit tight now, Ma. We figure you're about 30 hours away from us. Coast Guard's on the way down from Dago, but we should get there first. Take it easy. Everything'll be all right. Keep calling." "The Sarah signing off." May took off the earphones. She found herself listening, though she didn't know what for. Almost in a panic, she climbed up the ladder to the open con deck and started the engine. The muffler had gone out earlier in the season, and although the noise was almost unbearable at the wheel, they had been too broke to replace it. Now she found herself grateful for the ear-shattering din. What had she been afraid of? Was it only the silence? She looked at her watch. In 45 minutes she must get more ice. It was nearly dusk. The sun was a child's balloon, floating, red, in the sea. A few stars flickered tentatively in the eastern sky. On the fishing boat, Sarah, a young man, was cursing. "I told him," he cried. "Every goddamn year I told him. Cut it out. I knew something happened sooner or later. What for?" I asked him. The old bastard just grinned at me. They'd been in the red for 5 years. Couldn't even afford a lousy muffler this June. "Stay home," I said. Then she put it in her oar. I bought them a cottage out in Del Rio last winter. They spent 2 weeks in the goddamn place. I gave him money. Who the hell did he think he was? "Now take it easy, laddie," the old man who was captain said. "It's done. There's nothing you..." "Nothing," Sonny said. "Damn you, I know that." The captain walked away, leaving the young man alone. 2. There was so little time. She must go below and finish packing the fish. It was then, as she started for the ladder, that she noticed a white cloud of steam rising from the exhaust. Even as she turned off the ignition switch, May knew she was too late. The engine had been running for almost half an hour with no water to cool it. Only this morning Ed had mentioned that the impeller pump was out of kilter. But Ed had said so many things and she couldn't remember them all. Not now, not all at once. She climbed down to the engine room and repacked the gland in the pump with grease as she should have done earlier. Now, if she was lucky, it would draw water into the cooling system. She returned to the con with another load of ice and started up the engine once more. The sharp tapping sound grew louder. Steam rose from the exhaust again. Metal struck metal in a cruel staccato that rattled up from the heart of the old boat with the erratic urgency of a dying pulse beat. May winced as if her own body were being pummeled by the steel. She knew what had happened or was about to happen, but went below and called the Sarah anyway. This was the beginning of many things, things she must face, and even the poor comfort of a distant voice would help. Sonny switched off the receiver. The captain and two of the crew stood nearby. When the young man did not turn, the captain approached him. "No chance of keeping her going, Sonny?" The young man shook his head. "Rod gone." The words stood apart, wrenched from his throat. May wondered how long her radio batteries would last without the generator and the ice. There was the ice to consider. 30 hours, he had said. 30 hours she must wait. Time. 8 months of every year for 26 years. South every January to the cannery at Cabo San Lucas, where they took on a Mexican crew and worked the tuna as a bait boat. 5 months up and down Lower Baja into the Gulf, then south to the Tres Marias and the Sea of the Great Turtles. North in June for quick repairs in San Diego, and the months that followed were the hard ones, for they fished the albacore alone, using only 8 jig lines. South to San Quintin and Ballenas, where the gray whales bore their young. West to the Benitos, Guadalupe, and beyond. Home with a load and back down again. And always farther south it had been, farther west where others seldom fished, for as the years passed it became impossible for older boats like theirs to compete with the speedy clippers and purse seiners that swept the sea with nets so vast entire herds of porpoises were caught within them too. This year they had sailed 350 miles southwest of Guadalupe Island while the rest of the fleet was still working the coastal waters. When a storm surprised them, there was no time to beat for Guadalupe, nothing to do but ride it out. The storm had pushed them even farther westward, and two of their fuel tanks sprang leaks, until on the third day, when the weather lifted, they were forced to head directly for the island. And though they never spoke of such things, both had known they might not make it. Now, of course, this was no longer important. There was no engine to burn the fuel. There was no Ed. The situation almost seemed logical to May. Now she could do nothing about it, about anything. She must wait here for her son, and all that would inevitably follow, things she and Ed had avoided through the years. Never comfortable, perhaps, never quite safe, but independent and proud of the life they had made together. Ed had always said he would rather dig his own grave than live well like other people. And May, too, really, she too felt the same way. She could be certain of that at last. No more need to be loyal, to hide anything from the man she had spent these years with, who had given her this life, so different from that of other women. Yes, looking back, May knew it had been best their way, and if this life had finally killed Ed the way Sonny had always said it would, that was all right, too. 3. They had been heading toward Guadalupe for several hours. Ed was at the wheel. The afternoon sun glared down from clear, storm-washed skies. There was no wind, and the sea was glazed and steamy. May dozed beneath the canvas awning on the afterdeck, lazily checking the jig lines from time to time through half-open lids. She had taken off her boots because the albacore rarely struck in mid-afternoon. Then Ed was howling down at her from the con, and she saw one of the jig poles bending back at an angle that made the stay lines creak. A moment later, there was a second strike, and then another and another. Silver knives slashed across the mirrored sea. They were into something big. She cried out when she saw the first one. The line sang as he fought the bite of the hook, lunging and cutting through the water with a power that racked her muscles. She braced herself as she brought him up to the stern. An instant off guard, and she could have been dragged into the sea. A moment of carelessness, a slack line, and he would throw the hook. There was no pulling him in. He weighed 40 pounds at least. She waited for the time when, responding to the strain on the line, he leaped clear of the water in an orgasm of pain and fury, almost standing on his tail, and then she snapped him over the side. All the strength in her body and arms went into this quick movement, yet it would have seemed effortless to an observer. The barbless hook broke loose when the fish hit the deck, and she sent out the line again, seeing that it slid under the other so there would be no fouling. She called up to Ed as she went for the next line. Lunkers! They're lunkers! These were a variety of Japanese albacore rarely caught in these waters. They sometimes weighed as much as 80 pounds. Ed stood at the wheel, laughing, holding the boat in a circle course. Chum 'em! Don't lose 'em, honey! Be right there! And he started tying down the wheel. May climbed up on the bait tank and scooped up the squirming sardines. She tossed them out by the handful. Many landed on the deck, but there was no time to be careful. The school that surrounded them could sound and be gone in an instant. She hurried back to the lines. As she hauled them in, she could hear Ed talking to himself, cursing as he untangled some rope, chuckling. She didn't need to see him to know his face was flushed, that his hands were trembling as he tied down the wheel. She didn't need to look to know that his eyes were as bright as they had been on their first voyage. She, too, felt the same ecstasy when the sea spewed forth its harvest with such abandon. It had never occurred to May to wonder why each time was the first time for them, or to marvel that each day could hold the promise of moments like this, no matter how rare they might be. She chummed again. All 8 of the lines were taut now, and both jig poles were bent nearly double. The water boiled whenever she tossed the bait. Then Ed was beside her, a line in his hands, too, crying that there would be money in the bank this year and a new engine for the Gull, and they could look at all those mother-huggin' clipper men in the eye again with their fancy women and their goddamn Cadillacs. He had one of the albacore nearly up to the stern when he clutched his side. May saw his face go white, watched as he resisted the pain and tried to bring in the fish. Then he released the line, and she knew. He staggered toward the cabin, stumbled, and fell. She ran to him. He looked up at her, his face twisted grotesquely with the effort of speaking. "The lines!" he gasped. "God damn it, get the lines, May!" An hour later, when the school finally sounded, she went to him. He seemed lost in some dream, but though his body remained limp and still, his eyes met her as she approached. There was a question in them. 4 tons, she said. "We've got a load, Ed." She managed to smile. Then she dragged him into the cabin and somehow got him up on the bunk. He lay there, only his eyes alive. Suddenly it was too much for her. "What'll I do?" she cried. "Oh, Ed, tell me what to do." His eyes seemed to look beyond her for an instant. She turned but saw only a patch of blue sky outside the cabin door. "The Gull," he said. There was no sound, only his lips moved. And then he was dead, and she was alone. Terribly alone, for his last words had been the name of their boat. She had hoped for something more. "The gull," she murmured. Was there something she had missed, some significance here that she could not grasp? But her brain was numb with the one awful bald fact. He was dead. She couldn't think about it now. She had to think of the things she must do. May would never understand why she had turned off the ignition then. She found herself on the con deck, the engine dead. There is no stillness more oppressive and profound than that of the open sea when it is calm. The few times the engine had gone out before, there had always been Ed. And even if the sea had been at peace as it now was, there were always words to fill the void. May became aware of this stillness for the first time in her life. She was overcome by a stunning lethargy. She stared, unseeing, into the blue vastness which surrounded her. A familiar sound had roused her. One of the albacore was beating its tail against the bloody deck in sullen fury, as though trying to deny death in this last violent display of life. Its mouth opened and closed in yawning, hopeless gasps. Then, like a shadow passing over its shining scales, silver faded to gray, and the huge fish lay still. May climbed down from the con. The sun was hot, and there were 4 tons of fish waiting to be packed. The task before her was staggering. Even with Ed, it would have taken half the night. Usually Ed climbed into the freezing compartment first, stacked and covered the fish with finely ground snow ice as she handed them down to him. Then, when the cold became too much for him, they changed jobs. Ed wasn't here. She was alone. And, of course, there was something she must do before she packed the fish. She had been unable to reach the Sarah for a while. Someone had hit a big school east of Guadalupe, and the air was jammed. There wasn't a chance of getting through with her weak set. She began packing the fish, returning to the radio every few minutes. When she finally established contact, Sonny had confirmed her position with his radio direction finder. And then, of course, the authorities in San Diego were notified, for when a man dies anywhere, at sea, in the street, in his bed, everything must go through the proper channels. May kept the radio tuned in loud so that she could hear it, and returned to packing the fish. Working made things easier, except when she caught herself talking to him, or when she turned, expecting to find him beside her. A half hour later, she received a radio call from the health authorities in San Diego. They wanted to warn her that if she felt obliged to put the body of the man, her husband, in the ice hold, they must condemn the fish. And so the man had been packed in the gearbox on the con deck, and the Sarah was on its way, and the fish were saved. 4. The darkness surprised her. There was no moon tonight. May lit a kerosene lantern and set it by the hatch to the ice hold. She picked up an albacore and lowered it into the compartment, kneeling, for then she only had to drop it a few feet and the impact was slight. She rose, picked up another fish. May had guessed the average weight to be 35 or 40 pounds. About 200 fish. 200 times she must do this. When she went into the hold, the difference in temperature was immediately noticeable, though the refrigeration unit had been out less than an hour. Little drops of moisture had formed on the freezing pipes, white with encrusted ice, and they glowed yellow in the light of the lantern like a million tiny cat eyes, watching as she worked. May climbed up on the deck again. Her fingers were numb and she chafed them, but they remained thick and clumsy. Sometimes she dropped a fish and it fell with a thump into the hold, and she groaned and beat her fists against her thighs, because she knew a bruise had formed, marring the precious white flesh of the albacore. Too many of these in the cannery would reject the fish. She put on some canvas gloves, but before long they were as wet and slippery as her hands. And then it was time to go into the hold again. Soon she must call the Sarah. At 2 o'clock she had trouble hearing the Sarah. She turned up the volume as far as she could, but it didn't help. When they had taken a bearing, she signed off. The battery. And now there was the other thing to do. The night was warm. It almost seemed that the pale waxen skin of the dead man was generating some special heat, that some life force within it was still at work. She had to return to the hold and fill the pail again. As she scooped up the ice, she noticed that it stuck to the shovel, gray now instead of white and dry. Wearily, she climbed back to the con and went on with her grim task. His eyes glittered darkly in his white face. Strange that it should seem so white. It had been ruddy, a deeply tanned face. May remembered then that the eyes of the dead were supposed to be closed. She tried to accomplish this and was immediately sorry, for the right lid remained half open. Whichever way she forced it, whether open or shut, it kept returning to the same position. The effect was a leering wink, so grotesque, such a perversion of the man she knew, that May cried out. "Oh, oh, please!" She threw down the cover of the box. She leaned on it with all the weight of her body. She must open it again. She must pack the ice firmly about him and then get back to loading the fish. May shuddered. She felt as if the ice, the melting ice, were in her bones. The lantern on the deck below paled, then brightened. In the still darkness, the first tentative, chill, soft tongues of an approaching fog bank were sliding over the gull. Heartened by this, she clenched her teeth and opened the cover of the box once more. May was glad of the fog at first. Fog was cool and heat was her enemy. Perhaps it would last through the following day. That wouldn't be unusual in these waters. Then she remembered the dying radio. Without a direction finder to guide the Sarah, the fog had another meaning. Instead of heat, there would be time to contend with. She must live in this new time, think in the gray void enveloping her, grope for meanings that otherwise there might have been no time for. Kneeling beside the hold again, May stared into the dimming lantern and she saw herself alone. A woman not old, who had worn the clothes of a man for most of her adult life, unwomanlike in the eyes of other women who remained ashore, yet woman enough to have loved a man and borne his son. Old enough to accept what had happened this day, young enough to remember with hunger the feel of the man she had buried in the ice, preserving him and, yes, herself too, unseparate in the final numbing embrace for what must be done when they returned to land. Young enough to wonder what lay ahead of her and knowing it would only be time to be measured, time to forget the feel and the smell and the strength of this man, and, of course, strange to know this, when that time came, she too would be dead. May lowered the last fish into the hold. She didn't straighten up, but remained kneeling there, resting her head on the sharp edge of the hatch. Her back was one great dull ache. The muscle, the substance of her arms, might have dissolved into the chill fog except for the muted pain. The lantern had gone out, but that no longer mattered. It was dawn. There was a sun somewhere. She tried the radio again, but all she could hear was the faint echoes of voices. She took off the earphones and sat down on the bunk. There was a faint depression in the pillow where his head had rested. How long had it been? She was tired, so tired. She would lie down for a while, a little while, rest. She put her cheek on the pillow. When May awoke, the cabin was stifling. She rushed outside to find a hot sun burning down on the gull. Still, there was no wind. This seemed strange to her. How could the fog be gone if there was no wind? The hour startled her. 11 o'clock. She opened the hatch and entered the hold. She filled the pail with ice. This time she had to make 3 trips to the gearbox. Then she returned below to pack the last of the albacore. The reserve supply of ice was exhausted, and she had to chop what she could from corners and the freezing pipes. Even during the night there had been melting. Now great drops fell upon the deck in an erratic yet insistent rhythm, like some insane clock of water. When she was finished, May stood there for a while, watching, listening, trying to measure the time granted to her here. She noticed that one of the floorboards was out of place and discovered as she righted it that the bilge water had risen alarmingly. The engine room was flooding, too. Of course. May accepted this without emotion, like any natural event. Their little gull was an old lady, with the pumps gone, her seams caulked and recaulked 1,000 times over the years, wasn't enough to resist the sea. It was then, as she looked about her, that May wondered for the first time if she too might die. But no, there was the hand pump, and if worse came to worse, she could always load the dinghy with supplies and wait. Still, she found it necessary to think about this possibility. There was so little between her and the blue oblivion under the gull, nothing if one turned a valve and the sea cock were opened. May climbed quickly out of the engine room and went on deck. The sea was smooth and the sky was clear. She was alone. The horizon was a naked ring of nothingness, neatly encircling a woman and death. 5. Sonny stood at the wheel, the captain beside him. "Should get there about 11 tonight," the old man said. "Get where?" the young man replied bitterly. 12 hours had passed since they had been able to get a fix on the gull. "We'll find her," the captain said. May hardly knew how she had gotten in the engine room. She found herself staring at the valve to the seacock, not thinking of anything in particular, not thinking that. No, just there. The water had risen almost a foot in 2 hours. Soon the seacock would be covered and there would be no reaching it. But of course she didn't want to reach it. The sun would be setting by now. If the Sarah didn't arrive before dusk, she might have to wait another night. May considered loading the dinghy with supplies. She was too weary to move. Poor Ed. It wasn't right somehow. Going back to San Diego. Going back to the earth. The ground. The dirt. It would be more fitting for him to sink down into this blueness, become a part of what his life had been. His life and his death would be one thing then. Yes, that would be fitting. Well, maybe he'd get his wish if the Sarah didn't hurry. The ice in the gearbox had melted almost completely, though she had thrown a canvas tarpaulin over the box and wet it down constantly all afternoon. The sun was too hot on the exposed upper deck. The only ice left in the hold was packed about the fish, and if she moved him there, the fish would be condemned. May closed the cover to the gearbox. "I don't know. I don't know," she groaned, and scanned the empty, shimmering stillness of the sea, searching not for an answer, but for the intrusion of a decision. She wrung her hands. Kneeling, she opened the box again, looked into it, closed it. Ed wouldn't want things that way. The fish were a payload and something more, something she would never be able to explain, but she had a frightening conviction that it would be in the nature of a mortal sin to destroy them deliberately. In a sense, Ed had died for them. And what if she did what she knew he would want? What if she took him and sent him down into the sea? But of course she couldn't do that, for she must think of what people would say. She had his memory to consider. She rebelled at the idea of sniffling into this decision because people might think she prized a load of fish over her husband, or worse. But there it was. What if she left him in the gearbox? But in the heat, the thought was unbearable. One thing she could not do was leave him where he was. At dusk, there was no sign of the Sarah. She filled the kerosene lantern and hung it above the con, but she knew there was little chance of them finding her before morning. Now she must decide. She could wait no longer. There seemed to be some tremendous moral issue at stake that May didn't quite grasp, but it tortured her all the same. And it was complicated again by the sense of watchful eyes, the eyes of those who waited on land, of those who would be her neighbors in the new life ahead, of her son. But even at the thought of them, she knew they had nothing to do with Ed and her. They had always lived apart, and now at the end she must think apart from all the rest, alone now. May discovered then that she was not alone, even while staring full face into his deadness and the melted ice and the first hint of the ugliness of dirt graves. The decision belonged to him. It was done, and now there would be no smell of death on this boat. May felt clean in a way she would never wish or be able to define for anyone living. Now there would be the smell of the sea on this boat, and there would be only the good memories of this man. Memories, what poor things they were, fit for gray, shore-bound people, afraid to reach out for life any longer. It was done now, and there was no time for remembering. She must work to live, and she must live because she would find a reason. That would come to her. 6 o'clock. Morning. Second morning. Third day. May wondered how long she had slept this time. The water level hadn't risen much, not more than an hour. It had been like this all through the night. She worked until exhaustion. An old friend now swept her into unconsciousness, and her hands slid from the pump handle, and she slept a broken, troubled sleep, always awakening with a start, working again, and then the awakeness fading into dreams once more. But she wouldn't fall asleep now because it was morning and the Sarah would be here soon. She knew that. It was a thing that sang in her bones, as did the thought of what she would tell Sonny when he arrived. She had found her reason. No cottage in Del Rio for her. She would keep on fishing. Maybe Sonny would go in with her. Or if he was stubborn, she would find someone else. Sonny and Ed's family wouldn't like it. They would tell her she must rest a while. May knew all the dodges they'd use. That didn't worry her. And the wonderful part was she didn't need them. There was a little money in the bank, and at $400 a ton, this load would bring in close to $1,600, enough to put a new engine in the Gull. She was free. 6. The crew of the Sarah were listless. They mended nets, made lures, read comic books, sprawled about the deck or lying in their bunks. Occasionally some cast half-hearted looks toward the horizon, But they had reached an unspoken decision and just made this effort for the sake of the intense young man at the wheel. Only the old man, who was captain, seemed not to have given up hope. He had climbed up on the conn mast as soon as it was light. The cook tried to press some breakfast on him, but he shook his head and muttered, "No time." Though his perch was precarious, he felt no fatigue. His stubby-fingered, thick-veined hands and short, corded arms were like steel and leather, and time had only tempered them. His brown-seamed face was impassive, but his eyes were never still. He knew the sea too well to turn his back on her. She was a moody old woman, and she never did what you expected her to do. "Sonny, Sonny," he called softly, "hand me up the glasses." The young man at the wheel watched as the captain looked through the binoculars, then slowly lifted his arm and pointed. Sonny could see nothing. "Here, give it here," he said, reaching out as the old man descended from the conn mast. He moved the binoculars across the horizon. They wavered, stopped. The young man seemed to be choking. He handed the glasses to the captain, face averted, climbed down from the conn, and rushed into the darkness of the cabin. She had noticed the difference for some time, but had attributed it to any number of natural phenomena. A kelp bed was drifting nearby, and she knew this brown weed had a pungent odor and often bore the corpses of birds and fish. Later in the morning, a breeze sprang up, and she was able to ignore it for a while. She returned to the engine room, but still the memory of it troubled her. In 10 minutes, she was back on deck again. She made some coffee, forced herself to drink the hot fluid. A moment later, she was violently ill. This didn't last, for there was nothing in her stomach, but the nausea persisted. She had heard of such things happening to people who hadn't eaten for several days. She would try some bread when she felt better, something easy to digest, to coat her stomach. That was what was needed. She struggled to her feet, nearly fainted, leaned against the bulkhead. Perhaps she should wait a few minutes before returning to the pump. She breathed deeply, hoping this would make the dizziness go away. And suddenly she could elude it no longer. She went to the ice hold, removed the tarpaulin, and raised the hatch. She didn't have to look. She knew immediately. The ice had melted, and the sea and the heat had done the rest. The fish were lost. Ed's last cry, "Get the lines, May!" was a mockery in her ears now, and each moment she had lost with him seemed weighted to a raw string tightening about her heart. How often in their life it had been like this, always working, always fighting the sea, never quite winning. So many years, good years and bad years, the sea giving and taking in its own secret ways, all for nothing. Though she had given him to the sea, all for nothing. And so the last voyage was a failure. 7. The Sarah plowed northward, sluggish with its new burden. The sun and the sky were dulled by the thickening mesh of an ominous mackerel sky. Sonny put an arm around his mother. "Tough luck, Ma. If we'd have located you sooner, we might have saved him." "Yes," May said. She was looking back toward the Gull, which they were towing to Guadalupe Island. Two men were unloading the doomed catch of fish. "Hope there's no trouble about. Well, you know." May looked at her son with a curious, remote expression that made him flush. "He was my husband," she said. "Yeah, but people are funny, get funny ideas. You know that." "Yes. I guess we better just tell them the truth, though. I guess that's the only thing to do." May moved a little away from her son. His arm fell to his side. There was an uncomfortable silence. "Well, we'll have you home in a few days," Sonny said. "Coast Guard cutter's going to meet us at Guadalupe, and they'll take you north. I'll have to stay with the Sarah till we get a load." "What about the Gull?" "Engine's shot. I may be able to sell her for you, though. Get someone else to tow her to Dago." "I won't sell her." "Ma, she's dead. Finished. It'd cost you more'n you got in the bank to fix up that engine again, and then she wouldn't be worth a damn. Anyway, you can't fish alone." "I was thinking maybe you and I could go in together." She spoke slowly, as if she were reciting half-forgotten words memorized long ago. "Yeah, well, the thing is, old Larson'll be retiring next season, and when he does, I'll be skipper. I couldn't pass that up, Ma." "Maybe someone else." Sonny's voice grew querulous. "Well, I don't see what we can do, Ma. The boat's a dead loss unless you get it towed to port, and that'd cost a fortune. We can't take the time. Got to get in there fast with the load and get right back down here while they're running." "I won't sell her," May said. Her voice was mechanical, and the words had no meaning. She turned and walked away from her son. She leaned against the rail and looked into the sea. A boy emerged from the galley and eyed this strange, brooding woman curiously as he dumped a load of garbage over the side. A lone gull had been following the boat. It swooped toward the debris with a shriek. Although she hardly knew why, May found herself watching the bird. The gull, he had said, and May remembered. There had been a day soon after they were married. Ed had just bought the boat, and they had gone to Pacific Amusement Park to celebrate. Later in the afternoon, they walked down to the beach. The air was still warm, though already foghorns were beginning to moan at the entrance to the harbor. They were trying to think of a name for the boat, which had been called the Cella. They wanted something special, something for themselves. Sitting there on the sand, chatting idly, they began to watch a seagull. The bird had found a mussel among the rocks and was flying high into the air, then dropping it, trying to break the shell in order to reach the rich orange flesh. The bird tried this again and again, but the shell was too tough. Finally, it gave up and flew away. May had smiled at Ed and said she was glad she didn't have to work that hard for a living. Ed had frowned slightly. "Fishing's no picnic, you know, honey." "Oh, I know," she had said, but of course she didn't, not yet. A slight gasp made her look at Ed in concern. He was smiling now, and his voice was trembling with excitement when he spoke. "They really have to grub, May, but they can fly, too. Look, look up there." The gull had returned for some reason and was circling above them. The fog was rolling in, and the sun had paled to a moonstone in the thickening mists. There was a sudden chill in the air, but the gull was high above all this where the sun was still shining, and it soared through the bright sky with a wild, heartbreaking abandon, a glorious white golden thing free of the gray world below. And May had understood what Ed was trying to tell her, and she had turned to him and said, "Let's call her the gull." Ed had said nothing, but he took her hand in both of his in a funny, formal way. And though there had been a ceremony weeks before, May knew that now, in this instant, they were married. And standing on the stern of the great clipper Sarah, May found peace. They had grubbed. They had flown. They had been together. It was enough. It was all. The last voyage had not been a failure. It was only the end. And that story was The Last Voyage by Tom Filer from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The Duel by Nikolai Teleshov. It was early morning. Vladimir Kladinov, a tall, graceful young man, 22 years of age, almost boyish in appearance, with a handsome face and thick, fair curls, dressed in the uniform of an officer and in long riding boots, minus overcoat and cap, stood upon a meadow covered with new-fallen snow and gazed at another officer, a tall, red-faced, mustached man, who faced him at a distance of 30 paces and was slowly lifting his hand in which he held a revolver and aimed it straight at Vladimir. With his arms crossed over his breast and also holding in one hand a revolver, Gladinov, almost with indifference, awaited the shot of his opponent. His handsome young face, though a little paler than usual, was alight with courage and wore a scornful smile. His dangerous position and the merciless determination of his adversary, the strenuous attention of the seconds who silently stood at one side, and the imminence of death, made the moment one of terrible intensity, mysterious, almost solemn. A question of honor was to be decided. Everyone felt the importance of the question. The less they understood what they were doing, the deeper seemed the solemnity of the moment. A shot was fired. A shiver ran through all. Vladimir threw his hands about, bent his knees, and fell. He lay upon the snow, shot through the head, his hands apart, his hair, face, and even the snow around his head covered with blood. The seconds ran toward him and lifted him. The doctor certified his death, and the question of honor was solved. It only remained to announce the news to the regiment and to inform as tenderly and carefully as possible the mother, who was now left alone in the world, for the boy that had been killed was her only son. Before the duel, no one had given her even a thought, but now they all became very thoughtful. All knew and loved her and recognized the fact that she must be prepared by degrees for the terrible news. At last, Ivan Golubenko was chosen as most fit to tell the mother and smooth out matters as much as possible. Pelagia Petronova had just risen and was preparing her morning tea when Ivan Golubenko, gloomy and confused, entered the room. "Just in time for tea, Ivan Ivanovich," amiably exclaimed the old lady, rising to meet her guest. "You have surely called to see Vladimir." "No, I, in passing by," Golubenko stammered, abashed. "You will have to excuse him. He's still asleep. He walked up and down his room the whole of last night, and I told the servant not to wake him, as it is a holy day. But probably you came on urgent business?" "No, I only stepped in for a moment in passing. If you wish to see him, I will give the order to wake him up." "No, no, do not trouble yourself." But Pelagia Petronova, believing that he had called to see her son on some business or other, left the room, murmuring to herself. Golubenko walked excitedly to and fro, wringing his hands, not knowing how to tell her the terrible news. The decisive moment was quickly approaching, but he lost control of himself, was frightened, and cursed fate that had so mixed him up with the whole business. "Now, how can a body trust you, young people?" good-naturedly exclaimed Pelagia to her guest, re-entering the room. "Here I have been taking care not to make the least noise with the cups and saucers, and asking you not to wake my boy, and he has long ago departed without leaving a trace. But why do you not take a seat, Ivan Ivanovich, and have a cup of tea? You have been neglecting us terribly lately." She smiled as with a secret joy, and added in a low voice, "And we have had so much news during that time. Vladimir surely could not keep it. He must have told you all about it by this, for he is very straightforward and open-hearted, my Vladimir. I was thinking last night, in my sinful thoughts, well, when my Vladimir paces the room the whole night, that means that he's dreaming of Lenochka. That is always the case with him. If he paces the room the whole night, he will surely leave tomorrow. Ah, Ivan Ivanovich, I only ask the Lord to send me this joy in my old age. What more does an old woman need? I have but one desire, one joy, and it seems to me I shall have nothing more to pray for after Vladimir and Lenochka are married. So joyful and happy it would make me. I do not need anything besides Vladimir. There's nothing dearer to me than his happiness." The old lady became so affected that she had to wipe away the tears which came to her eyes. "Do you remember," she continued, "things did not go well in the beginning, either between the two or on account of the money. You young officers are not even allowed to marry without bonds. Well, now everything has been arranged. I have obtained the necessary 5,000 rubles for Vladimir, and they could go to the altar even tomorrow. Yes, and Lenochka has written such a lovely letter to me. My heart is rejoicing." Continuing to speak, Pelagia Petronova took a letter out of her pocket, which she showed to Golubenko and then put back again. "She is such a dear girl, and so good." Ivan Golubenko, listening to her talk, sat as if on red-hot coals. He wanted to interrupt her flow of words, to tell her that everything was at an end, that her Vladimir was dead, and that in one short hour nothing would remain to her of all her bright hopes. But he listened to her and kept silent. Looking upon her good, gentle face, he felt a convulsive gripping in his throat. "But why are you looking so gloomy today?" the old lady at last asked. "Why, your face looks as black as night." Ivan wanted to say, "Yes, and yours will be the same when I tell you." But instead of telling her anything, he turned his head away and began to twirl his mustaches. Pelagia Petronova did not notice it, and wholly absorbed in her own thoughts, continued, "I have a greeting for you. Lenochka writes that I should give Ivan Ivanovich her regards and should compel him to come with Vladimir and pay her a visit. You know yourself how she likes you, Ivan Ivanovich. No, it seems I'm not able to keep it to myself. I must show you the letter. Just see for yourself how loving and sweet it is." And Pelagia Petronova again took out the package of letters from her pocket, took from it a thin letter sheet, closely written, and unfolded it before Ivan Golubenko, whose face had become still gloomier, and he tried to push away with his hand the extended note, but Pelagia Petronova had already started to read. "Dear Pelagia Petronova, when will the time arrive when I will be able to address you, not as above, but as my dear sweet mother? I am anxiously awaiting the time, and hope so much that it will soon come, that even now I do not want to call you otherwise than Mama. Pelagia Petrovna lifted her head and, ceasing to read, looked at Golubenko with eyes suffused with tears. "You see, Ivan Ivanovitch," she added, but seeing that Golubenko was biting his mustaches and that his eyes, too, were moist, she rose, placed a trembling hand upon his hair, and quietly kissed him on the forehead. "Thank you, Ivan Ivanovitch," she whispered, greatly moved. "I always thought that you and Vladimir were more like brothers than like simple friends. Forgive me. I am so very happy. God be thanked." Tears streamed down her cheeks, and Ivan Golubenko was so disturbed and confused that he could only catch in his own her cold, bony hand and cover it with kisses. Tears were suffocating him, and he could not utter a word. But in this outburst of motherly love, he felt such a terrible reproach to himself that he would have preferred to be lying himself upon the field, shot through the head, than to hear himself praised for his friendship by this woman, who would in half an hour find out the whole truth. What would she then think of him? Did not he, the friend, the almost brother, stand quietly by when a revolver was pointed at Vladimir? Did not this brother himself measure the space between the two antagonists and load the revolvers? All this he did himself, did consciously, and now this friend and brother silently sat there without having even the courage to fulfill his duty. He was afraid. At this moment he despised himself, but could not prevail upon himself to say even one word. His soul was oppressed by a strange lack of harmony. He felt sick at heart and stifling. And in the meanwhile time flew. He knew it, and the more he knew it, the less had he the courage to deprive Pelagia Petrovna of her few last happy moments. What should he say to her? How should he prepare her? Ivan Golubenko lost his head entirely. He had had already time enough to curse in his thoughts all duels, all quarrels, every kind of heroism, and all kinds of so-called questions of honor, and he at last rose from his seat ready to confess or to run away. Silently and quickly he caught the hand of Pelagia Petrovna, and, stooping over it to touch it with his lips, thus hid his face, over which a torrent of tears suddenly streamed down. Impetuously, without another thought, he ran out into the corridor, snatching his great coat, and then out of the house without having said a word. Pelagia Petrovna looked after him with astonishment and thought, "He also must be in love, poor fellow. Well, that is their young sorrow, before happiness." And she soon forgot him, absorbed in her dreams of the happiness which seemed to her so inviolable and entire. And that was The Duel by Nikolai Telishov from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And now from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Turning by Linda Sexton. Three elderly ladies, elegantly turned with jewels on their elongated necks, helped one another to hobble from the taxi to the walk. They came toward the house, their white curled heads nodding, anticipated by the little boy watching from behind the curtain. They looked like a motion picture of three swans gliding and bobbing on a pale lake, but caught in a faulty, halting projector that was chewing up the frames of their finale. It was as though these fine creatures could not be crippled. It was merely the illusion of a flawed presentation of them. Inside the house, they settled into Queen Anne chairs, prim but for their knees, which would no longer stick together. They looked like great water birds, forced not only onto dry land, but into human forms that did not suit them. The little boy pushed his trucks on the carpet near them, making highway sound effects for their entertainment. He peeked into the darkness under their skirts, which was like looking into his viewmaster without the reels. They turned their heads from side to side, examining the boy, like birds who have an eye to each hemisphere. The boy's mother brought out a decorated cake with four candles, bone china cups for the tea, and a glass of milk with a strawberry in it. "Why, this cake says Robert. The cake has the same name as you," said the first lady to the boy. He giggled and fell back on the carpet. "No," he shrieked. "It's my birthday, Louise dear." He followed religiously their pet names for one another, pronouncing them with formality and deference. They were Louise dear, Olivia sweet, and Ruth love. Every time he said those names, it gave them rare little reverberations of pleasure in their old flesh, like spreading circles on the surface of water. "Why then," said Ruth, "this pretty box must be for you. It says, "Happy Birthday." Robert shredded the wrapping paper and found a shirt bearing an appliqued lion's face with a yarn mane on the front and a cloth tail attached to the back. Robert put it on over his other shirt. He got the buttons wrong. He watched Ruth's fingers work to correct his carelessness. Her knobby fingers looked like bleached, brittle twigs. Robert wondered if they could push the buttons through, not realizing that the lion had been crafted by those same fingers. His mother lit the candles. The lady sang, "Happy birthday, dear Robert," like the air rushing from leaky organs. Olivia gave him a package of crayons that willfully changed colors as they were used. Robert drew a picture of them on the large drawing paper that accompanied the crayons. The ladies smiled to see themselves emerge as armless floating shapes, with stick fingers at the sides of ruffled heads, each finished with a distinct and careful navel. He gave the drawing to Olivia. "We never expected to receive a beautiful present on your birthday," she thanked him. They passed the drawing around and cooed at it. Luis gave him a package with so many bows it looked like a little animal. Robert chose to keep it as it was, not to look inside yet. The ladies laughed and winked. He served them cake, which they faced as birds would face seeds and crumbs smeared with sticky frosting. Robert waited until they politely abandoned the cake. He leaned into Olivia Sweet's lap, wadding her silky dress with his moist fists. "Let's have a story now." His mother gathered the dishes and left them to their ceremonies. "This is the story," she said vaguely, "of the emperor who had no skin." "No clothes," corrected Luis. "No flesh," agreed Ruth. Olivia's way with stories was to take a great solid wall of a story and knock a chink in it with one word, making it possible and necessary to peer through the chink to the other side. Her story, then, was already told. The chink in the old story was itself the new one. They had only now to find it out by playing it out. "Once upon a time," she said, "there was an emperor who had no skin. He looked like ivory carvings and cream-colored satin cushions all laced together with fine red and blue threads. The emperor would have been happy but for two things. He wondered why he alone had no skin, and he longed for a wife. As he was very rich, very wise, and extremely handsome," the other ladies arched their eyebrows, "he came to realize that he himself was a riddle. So he said whatever princess should answer his riddle should become his wife. At last a beautiful princess with golden hair and a blue brocaded gown came to his palace. And," Louise took up, "she said to the king, 'I have woven a skin for you from my own golden hair. Just pull it tightly at the top. Once you're in, by this green cord I plaited from the vines that cling to the church walls. For the riddle of your skin is that it must embrace you like a loving wife and find you like a vine finding its way to the tower.'" Olivia, who knew that stories, if not tended, could trickle away, broke in harshly. "But the emperor tried on the skin and knotted the cord and looked in the mirror. He said, 'I look like a mesh bag of nuts and oranges tied with a shoestring in this skin.' He tore it from himself, and the princess left weeping." Louise blinked several times in the silence until Ruth said excitedly, discreetly dabbing at the bit of saliva escaping the corner of her painted mouth, "But another beautiful princess came to the emperor and told him that she understood his riddle. To be without his skin, she explained, was to be closer to the world, and yet without skin was to never feel its petty pricks and pains. And this princess," said Ruth triumphantly, "rolled off her skin like removing a silk stocking so that she could be like the emperor and become his bride." "Yes," Olivia intervened, and spilled herself out onto the emperor's royal carpet. "It took 20 royal maids 20 days picking her up and removing her by the thimblesful." Luis and Ruth looked at Olivia. Robert, hearing only the story told but not noticing the story between the tellers, said, "Another princess came." "Yes," Olivia said. "Tell us, Robert, about this princess." "This princess," said Robert, "was red and blue and green and beautiful, and said to the king, 'I'm going to give you a good skin to wear.' And she took off the skin of her best and favorite big dog and gave it to the king. The dog died, but the king said, 'I like the skin because it is fluffy and because it gives me a tail to wag.' And he did." "But Robert," said Louise, "that doesn't answer the riddle." "Oh, but it does," said Olivia, to Robert's relief. They all waited for her to continue. At last she said, "You tell us, Robert. The other ladies knew then that the story had turned to one that Olivia could not swim. "Well," said Robert, "you know, Olivia, sweet, the riddle is that animals have good skins and people would like tails."
"There you have it," said Olivia.
"But," complained Ruth, "why was the emperor without his skin in the first place? That's part of the riddle."
"So we could find him one," said Robert confidently.
"Insufficient, Robert," said Olivia, and he sensed that she meant for him to say more.
"So he could look at the inside of himself before he got married to a princess?" he asked.
"Excellent," exclaimed Olivia, and seemed about to soar into the air.
"I didn't know the answer to that riddle myself," she confided, and the other two applauded the boy.
"Don't ever forget," said Louise, "to look at the inside of yourself before you marry a princess."
"And," said Robert, unable to stop the momentum of his success, "if you wait a long time for a skin, you get one without a tail." They laughed and petted him, but he perceived that his last answer was not as good as his former one. He wondered why, as he himself would trade off a dozen princesses for one tail. The ladies rose to leave. He kissed them on their thin, powdered cheeks and felt how their skins didn't quite fit them and wondered. As Olivia kissed him, she said, "Don't ever, Robert, look for morals after you find out riddles." Squeezed into their taxi, they looked like large fowls stuffed into a crate for market. They waved their white gloves at the house toward the space pulled in the curtain. And that story was Turning by Linda Sexson, from Sun Fiction, American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.